Gaming on the Frontier. This is Bruce.
This is Trav.
And this is Jonathan.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier, your podcast of saying, we've been here before, and what is that there?
So have you ever experienced deja vu?
Vuja day, most of the time.
All over again.
So have you ever experienced deja vu?
All right. Anyways, welcome to Gaming on the Frontier. This week we are talking about not exactly reusing old adventures, but more like repurposing,
recycling,
callback, yeah. Recycling. I mean, in the sense that there were some really good adventures. I mean, if you've been around as long as the hosts on this show have been, we have had some really super adventures that either we ran or we played in. And it's really a shame to have done it be once and done in some of those cases. So we're going to talk about how you, either convince your GM or as a GM could say, hey, let's bring that back and let's see if we can recapture that magic, and possibly even make it better than it was. So for a whole new set of people. So, okay, so we've all done that to a point. So it's fun to do that. And if you're doing something, you know, one of the ways you can change things up. If you are going to run an adventure that's done before and you're concerned about the fact that people may have played it before, people may have remembered it, Keep on the Borderlands, anything from Faerun, you know, Waterdeep.
Yeah,
because there's whole detailed maps of Waterdeep. So you know, I play in a D&D game, and yeah, he's doing stuff in Waterdeep, and I'm like, okay, and he's got maps and everything, but so how do you keep that fresh without, you know, feeling like as a GM, I've already run adventures myself in Faerun, so how does he keep it so that I don't get bored? So, first of all, keep in mind, there's one thing about using old adventures. Let's say there's two types. There's old adventures that are published, and then there's old adventures that you did, okay? So if you're doing an old adventure that you did, remember, there's a couple of things you keep in mind. You don't remember it as well as you think you do, unless you did exhaustive notes that you kept in a vault, okay? You probably have... You may have lost your notes. They may have had, you know, they may have faded. You know, ink fades.
Yeah.
And it may be unreadable, and you may just have an old map that you're working from in your memory. So the adventure you come up with may only be slightly like the old adventure, which is fine. But that, you know, because it brings all the emotional frisson that you're looking for. And, you know, but then you can do whatever you want. You don't have to feel like you're bound to everything that you did before, you know, because otherwise you might be afraid that it's not going to be good. You know, is lightning going to strike twice? You know, well, it probably is not going to be like that, okay? Also, you should keep in mind the fact that you're not the same player or GM that you were. You know, I mean, when I ran those AD&D games, I was a fledgling GM. I didn't know how to run. I was slavishly looking up monster stats and you know, what's the rules for traps and stuff like that. And people took terrible advantage of me, you know, because they would say, oh, no, it's like this. I'm sure of it. And I'm like, okay, because, you know, I can't remember everything. Those books, there's like 200 pages in the Dungeon Master's Guide and 150 in the Player's Guide and all those spells, and people would lie to me about what their stuff did, and I would just nod and say, okay.
Well, I think that's because also you had it in your head. Oh my God, I don't want to have to look it up. It'll slow the game down. Yeah, I don't want to disrupt the work, the game flow. Yeah.
Well, I was afraid of not playing the game right. So that people could tell, you know, so when people said, no, it's like this, Bruce, I'd be like, oh, okay, because I didn't want to assume that they didn't know what they were talking about, because I knew I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, those early modules were great because everything was spelled out. You had all the monsters, monster blocks, yep. You had all the maps and stuff like that. Those were really nice, you know, so, but that got me started, at least, you know, on those early adventures, you know. Because I think I did like 8 of the first ones that were ever published. The Keep on the Borderlands, the Shrine of Tukachimen, the Slaver Stockade stuff, Against the Giants.
I've reused that one too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I never quite understood how anybody was meant, who was, of course, the problem I usually had was, is that they're like, for players 8 to 10th level. And I'm like, you know, dude, we got like, first and second level characters, third level characters, what am I supposed to do? You know, and I have lots, I have one character that got so abused by that. He was always the lowest level character in the party. And they would say, okay, well, our average party height is, you know, is 5. What level are you, Bruce? 2nd. Oh, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Oh man, that got, you know, so first level, Ancient Red Dragon. Third level, Demon Web Pits. Fifth level was Demon Web Pits. Eighth level, was the I can't think of it now. It was this haunted tower.
Okay, I think I remember that vaguely. Yeah.
Anyways, I'm just saying I'm sorry. No, third level was Demon Web Pits. Fifth level was Stormbringer.
Ouch.
And then I finally got something that was appropriate to my level, where, you know, basically the GM screwed us all over and said, oh yeah, this effect goes off and every item you have has now been denatured and it's not magical anymore. And all of us are like, all of our magic is gone? Are you kidding me? Yeah, so anyways. But yeah, that character was abused because of that, you know. Halfway through the Demon Web Pits, they put a ring of regeneration on me, but I just kept dying and they kept dragging me along. And finally they said, okay, somebody got out the Aparazicoalish, which is basically like a robotic crab. And I got inside that because it gave me like 100 extra hit points.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was able to fight and operate from that point on. So I was able to get through the Demon Web Pits that way. But I'm just saying, it was ridiculous. So, yeah, a lot of it, but see, when you're reusing these old adventures, because you know you're reusing them, you know, you can change things up. You can, like, downgrade, upgrade, you know, and you don't have to feel bad about it because, you know, especially because you're an older GM, you're more experienced and seasoned
in, yeah,
those kind of on-the-fly changes. You don't have to feel like I was at the beginning saying, I can't change anything in this module because it's all like been put together like a puzzle box and deftly crafted. And, you know, I'm sure that if I said that to the people who wrote it, they like looked at me and said, I had 2 weeks to get that module done.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then I had 3 more modules in the pipe I had to get to. So it's okay, man. You know, it's not as good as you think.
There is something that is good. Okay, I mentioned earlier Dungeon Crawl Classics by Goodman Games, the 3.0, right. 3.0. Okay, they have rules if your characters are of lower level than what they have or higher level. Like higher level, it's usually add some levels of fighter or rogue to this, up the DCs of the traps by 2 or 3.
Up the damage dice of the traps.
Yeah. And, for lore, let's say this is 5th to 7th. Let's say your characters are 2nd to 4th. Okay, knock down the hit dice of these creatures, lower the DCs and damage dice of the traps. Instead of bugbears, make them goblins. They have those rules in, like, the first fit, because Dungeon Crawl Classics is now its own game, its own system, but for, like, the first 50 modules or so, for 3035, they had those tips, and they were like maybe on the first three pages of the module. They would already tell you, is scaling up or scaling down?
Right. Yeah. But as an experienced GM, you already know how to do
that. Well, yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah. I went and bought like one of those Humble Bundles
that was good in the games.
Yeah. And I got like 30 adventures for like, you know, $10, $20. I can't remember.
Oh, no. Humble Bundle is wonderful. Yes, we love you, Humble Bundle.
And I gave it to my GM for D&D, and he looks at me and says, nah, I'm doing my own stuff. And I'm like, well, dang, I'm going to use it then.
Yeah.
So it's not what caused me to think of this topic, but I mean, really, I haven't gotten around to really looking through them because, yeah, I can really see using these adventures because, like I say, they're put together. I still have a bunch of Judges Guild adventures.
Oh yeah, I remember them. Yeah.
Super trash, not sellable, but they're, you know, and one was this like a thief fortress on an island, and I have used that a bunch of times, you know, in various campaigns and things like that, because you know you could just ignore the fact that it was some thieves. You just put whatever you want in there. It's a nice fortress, yeah. So it's good to do. So so a lot of times, like I say, these, you know, because I think some of the third party, whatever, write their adventures a little bit more generically, you know, because they want to, you know, especially these days, they want to be able to say, well, you could use it on, I remember they used to say, for, you know, good for any fantasy role-playing game.
Yeah.
You know, and back in the day, I you know, when we were talking to Richard about an updated version of his game system, you know, we said, well, he says, you know, you could just say things like, what we've always said was, it's a real tough roll, or it's an easy roll, or it's a challenging roll, or, yeah, you know, you're not, it's a roll you're probably not going to make unless you're really, really experienced, you know, and use descriptive terms for like these kinds of things instead of putting a level on it, you know, where you, because that way you could just look at the players and say, well, no matter what level they are, you know, it's going to be an easy roll, or it's going to be, you know, or you could just simply say, yeah, you know, based on, you know, those are all based on, you know, first level characters, and so therefore, you know, then you have to do that modification. But yeah, I like descriptions like that because it's really easy to roll them up and down with the level of the characters.
Oh, speaking of Dungeon Crawl Classics, I remember another one that I did of theirs, and I put it in a superhero campaign. It was the Lost Tomb of the Sphinx Queen, and I just based it in Egypt.
Yeah.
And I've, this is all, the Sphinxes were aliens, and so all the pockets, with all, you know, the pocket dimension, you go down the steps of the Sphinx, and you're underground and all this. Yeah, it was just, you know, dimensional engineering, you know, pocket dimensions where all these monsters are kept. I've also used, for Bureau 13, and I think another superhero game, from Necromancer Games, their City of Brass. And I printed this out. This is in a huge honking three-ring binder. It's almost like a three-inch three-ring binder, like the really thick ones. Printed that out. No, I use the, you basically go to a small seaside town in an Middle Eastern-esque country. And I did it as, okay, these guys are of a very small sect of Islam. Okay, here you go. There's this, there's Suleiman, who was separated from Allah and all this. And I even did the whole thing because I knew that there were none of my players practice Islam. But still, I said, okay, I'm going to be dealing with some stuff here that I know none of you practice religion, but you still, we're going to, you know, I get a content warning, we'll call it. But yeah, I put it in where you're fighting these jinn that are orbiting this city because this temple was desecrated. And they came in with modern tech and stuff, and they were just doing all this. So, yeah, it was, I think City of Brass came out probably mid-2000s, and it was for 3.0, so it's like, this is already like a 15, almost 20-year-old module. And it's like a campaign setting. You eventually get to the City of Brass with the Afridi, and you find out all the, you know, the big plot about the Sultan, which is, you know, the king of all Afridi and everything. So that and Lost Tomb of the Sphinx Queen are another two. I'm trying to see if there are any others here. I think it's just Lost Tomb of the Sphinx Queen and the Dungeon Interludes, and then I was about to say Keep on the Borderlands. No. Expedition to the Barrier Peaks and the Three Giants module, Against the Giants. I did the TSR reboot they did for like their 25th anniversary. So it was like a big thick paperback, and it was like a silver cover, new art and everything. Yeah. So I think those are the four that I've used from the old school days, you know, back way back 20, 30, 40 year old modules. Let's see there. Yeah, I think those are the four that I know that I've used, and just, they have not failed me. They are classics for a reason.
Well, that's great. You know, and one of the ways you can, you know, if you're worried at all about, you know, them recognizing the module and you don't want them to, one of the things you can do is you can change the setting to another climate.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Put that castle in the middle of a jungle. Put that cave in the Arctic. You know, just, you know, I mean, to keep on the Borderlands, just, you know, they say move it to the middle of a desert. You're not going, you know, if you change the monsters that are in the caves, they'll probably never recognize it. So, you know, and the caves, of course, can be like, you know, abandoned giant ant hills or something. So, yeah, you can do that kind of stuff. So even put it underwater. You know, that is always a favorite thing of mine, is to have something aquatic. And so all the players are basically running around in mini subs and or they have to have some kind of, like, you know, rings of water breathing or whatever.
Ah, yeah.
And then the lizard warriors are now Yagtua, and so forth. I mean, I'm just saying, you just switch up all the monsters. You can even keep them at the same level of power. You just swap in monsters that are appropriate to the new setting, and it's like they never did the adventure before.
So instead of a red dragon, a white dragon, it's in the Arctic. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Or a dragon turtle. Because they always treat dragon turtles like they're stupid, and of course maybe they are in D&D, but, you know, there's no reason why they have to be. So, yeah. And there's certainly lots and lots, and, you know, so instead of fire lizards, you can have like a sonic lizard, because the sonic weapon works great underwater.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we already mentioned just changing, you know, you can change the power level that we can really radically change the adventure from what they remembered to something else. And you can also change the final objective. You know, because, I mean, all these are like, you know, most of these, they have some kind of adventure story baked in. You know, there's at the end of it, you got the BBG, but who's, you know, BBG could be somebody different this time. By making that change, the effects will ripple back through the story, changed decorations inside the place, especially if you change up the NPCs. As well, you know, instead of you talking to a guy, you talk to a girl, or you talk to a monster or whatever, and all of a sudden that old familiar module is new and very, very much different, and you get challenged because you're not just running an adventure you know very well, because now you have to come up with the right words. I'm not going to say the right accent, because I'm terrible at that. But, you know, if you're good at that, yeah, different accents. Of course, if you change genders, that's always going to make a difference. So, you know, it's these old adventures that you know, especially if they were published, can be almost unrecognizable with just a few tricks like this. Now, the other types of adventures are the old original adventures that you wrote yourself. And, you know, if you wrote good notes, then, yeah, you know, but a lot of times what they act is they act more like story hooks. They act more like, you know, ideas of what you want an adventure to be. You know, you think of the moments that was really cool in that adventure, and then try to set up a similar situation in an adventure that you're currently writing. Because you don't have, you know, you can mine these adventures. You don't have to, you know, But if you do want to do it like it was, then you still can, but you might have trouble. You might have problems if you have long memory players. But if you don't, if you've got new players, yeah, it's the same thing. It's easy. Now you can take it easy. You know, I always feel like I need to take every once in a while, I want to take it easy on an adventure. So my players, however, are like, you know, like dogs and squirrel, you know, zoom, gone. So, you know, usually it's not too hard for me to get them into a situation where they're just going to sit around and chat amongst themselves for an entire session while I get some downtime. But that's not usually what I'm trying to do. But, you know, then you do this, do you guys have a thing when you really want to get things going again? What's your go-to as far as jazzing up the situation? Jonathan?
Jazzing up the situation.
Just impromptu jazzing the situation up. You think they've gotten too complacent. You just want to get to something else. Now for something entirely different. Monty Python reference.
Yep. Ah, I see.
What's your go-to?
Betrayal. Somebody betrays them. A trusted friend or NPC or contact turns out to have been a mole or enemy agent working against them behind the scenes the entire time.
You bastard.
Yeah. But it works. Completely changes. Well, no, I was just going to say it completely changes. I mean, if we're talking about, like, I feel like the course of the campaign has been kind of stagnant and things aren't working out or they don't seem to have any motivation, I just throw that one in at them. And suddenly they have at least one motivation. Kill that guy.
How about you, Trav?
Oh, stagnant campaign.
Not campaign, just I'm saying the session's been kind of been getting a little bit lackluster. You know, they seem to be getting too comfortable about, you know, getting into their shopping lists, or, you know, they just don't seem to be, you know, the excitement level of the adventure just isn't getting high. It doesn't seem to be very high, and you want it higher.
Usually I will sudden emergency. Just, yeah, it could be anything from power went out and something happens there, or just some sudden event to jar them back into, oh crap, what do we do? Yeah. And it just depends on the situation. As I said, if it's like a Bureau 13 game, you know, you're at your base or whatever and the power goes out, or fringe worthy, you know, it could be fringe. I'll just something sudden, just immediate. Like there's no check for a perception check, you're flat footed and just boom. Just something as sudden and jarring as possible. Just get everybody up in their seats again. Okay, we got to, you know, yeah.
Okay. My go-to is blow something up.
Okay, that kind of sounds like an extreme version, but something just exploded. What are you doing? Yeah.
Yeah, no, really, it's like usually what happens is that there's an NPC and he says, okay, you know, I just threw a grenade at that guy over there. Why? I didn't like the way he looked at me. Or, we need to get to the wall. Explosives work. Or something like that. You know, they're all looking at me going, Bruce, really? You know, and I'm like, he's a crazy guy. You know, I don't control him. In fact, of course I do, but I'm just saying it's like, you know, Heinlein talking about how his characters did that, you know, or Samuel Clemens, you know, when they said, you know, how can you, you know, have this kind of dialogue not Tom Sawyer, the other one, Huck Finn. And he says, I'm sorry, but, you know, I can't control Huck. He's a foul-mouthed person, and Joe's a slave, and he's had no proper upbringing whatsoever. I can't control them. He literally said that to his detractors, who said that, because apparently there were some words and things that they were saying to, you know, in the book, because he was trying to illuminate the fact that slavery was wrong. So they were saying things that people were being scandalized by, and he said, I'm sorry, they're just these, they're not educated and cultured people here in this story, so you can hardly expect them to speak properly. So I would blow things up, throw a stick of dynamite, or have someone else, NPCs do it. You know, it's it always gets everybody's blood going. You know, they're always like, what do? You know, and I've never seen them say, well, I'm just going to ignore it and keep doing what I'm doing. No one has ever done that. He says, all right, bye. You know, he says, you know, it's, he says, the mechs are banging at the front door. They're like, okay. where's my blaster rifle? He says, we'll have to get back to this whole thing about why the king is engaging in this strange behavior with his, you know, with it, his council. You know, is he controlled? Or are they controlled? I don't. We'll have to figure that out later. Right now, we got to keep from dying because Bruce decided to suddenly have a combat sequence.
It's fight time now.
And I just look at him going, what can I do? Because I was bored. You know, the GM's allowed to have fun too, you know. So now, I don't know whether this calls into, I've learned and I'm not that person anymore. I think I'm still that person. So if this is a bad thing, I haven't learned that lesson yet. Anyways, Trav, you went and are doing the barrier peaks.
Yes.
Okay. If you were to, Jonathan, if you were to do one in the future, is there something? Is there an iconic adventure that you would want to run that you haven't thought about doing, or you never thought you had the opportunity to do?
Just to twist people's minds, and I haven't dug too deep into it, but I would very much consider doing Undermountain in a futuristic setting.
Huh, okay. Yeah, I keep hearing about that. I've even done a little bit of it. Isn't there a video game that actually does some of that?
I can't remember. I don't know about
it. Yeah, I mean, it's just the whole Undermountain. What is the Undermountain? Isn't it just a dwarf?
No, it's a giant funhouse dungeon. Set in the Forgotten Realms under Waterdeep.
Oh, okay. Waterdeep. Yeah. Okay.
So it's in Waterdeep.
It's under Waterdeep, yeah.
Okay.
And it was created by Halaster, the Mad Mage.
Uh-huh.
And he was already insane when he made it, and he just went more insane as he expanded it. And he brought in apprentices who also went insane, and some of them still live there in it. And he made it just strictly to just mess with people because he was insane. And it's part lab, part trap, part I'm just gonna do whatever I want. And I think I think there was one interpretation of it back in the day where the bottom levels, there was a bowling alley because Halaster liked to bowl because he visited Earth and liked bowling.
Yeah, I think all the iconic mages in D&D at one time or another visited modern day Earth. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I found the second edition, The Ruins of Undermountain.
Yeah.
Part one and part two, the deep levels. That deep levels probably has the bowling alley.
Yeah, and they re-released it for fifth edition as a two-part adventure.
Oh.
Or two splat books. Or, no, I'm sorry, source books. Where really, the first one, you don't go into Undermountain, but the second one is all about going into Undermountain. And it's a little bit pared down compared to the original. I mean, a little bit. It's a lot pared down compared to the original, but I think it would just make an interesting, like, just take the same idea of a crazy rich person building a space base or space habitat, and it's just Undermountain.
You know what that reminds me of? The whole concept of Undermountain and yours? The Fantastic Four villain arcade, where he had these elaborate, you know, things at the Fantastic Murder World. That's what it was.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I'm getting that vibe from. It just I'm like, oh yeah, that. I remember them. I remember the old Marvel Superheroes module of Murder World. It has this giant arcade who's like a little, okay, arcade, for those of you who don't know, he's probably this guy like 5 feet tall, bright red hair, always wears white suits, maniacal smile. And he built these elaborate death traps, and he was a Fantastic Four enemy. And so Reed, Sue, Johnny, and Ben would have to go through these just almost like enclosed amusement parks with the safety protocols off. it's like an ocean nightmare, you know, just
yeah.
And just yeah, that's what he did. And they did, I think, a module in the old Marvel Superheroes TSR game, and it was just called Murder World, and you went through it. Yeah. Trying to see if they had that Undermountain for well, they have City Splendor's Waterdeep. I'm looking real quick to see if they...
I mean, you could easily see one of those old Funhouse dungeons being like a story verse in a Fringeworthy world.
Oh, there
somewhere.
You go, yeah.
Some pocket Ooh, yes. stop that's just a chance for some Commonwealth, you know, civilians to just get their D&D on.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't actually know of any classic adventures that I would really want to run because, frankly, I would have run it by now, I think, if I really wanted to. But I did hear about one recently, which is it's Murder on the Orient Express, except it's Cthulian.
Oh. Oh.
Yeah. And I'm like going, ooh, that sounds very interesting. Like something that, you know, that I could like, you know, throw people onto, literally. So there is a guy out there. He claims to have written over 500 short adventures on his blog, and it's called elventower.com, www.elventower.com, normal spelling. So that's if you're looking for adventures to mine, sounds like a good spot. We highly recommend Dungeon Crawl Classics. Of course, there's people are constantly putting out stuff, you know, like old Judges Guild things. They appear and disappear. I mean, right now, I don't know if you know this, but you know, D&D modules and materials, things like that, is because of, you know, certain online play, their values have gone through the roof. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know. So getting some of these original Judges Guild and stuff like that is very hard because Judges Guild doesn't exist anymore. And as far as I know, nobody actually really owns their properties.
I think Goodman Games had it for a little while because I remember seeing, okay, there's an adventure planner for DCC. And they mentioned in, oh, this level of adventure, it was a Judges Guild module. So I think Goodman Games might have had it for a while. And I don't know if they still do. Yeah, I remember seeing, I'm going to talk amongst yourselves. I'll look it up and get back to you.
Okay. Anyways, but what I'm saying, though, is that there's, you know, there are lots of people out there that have, have in a sense, you know, they tried to do throwbacks to some of these early adventures, but with their own spin on it. And there, it's a good way of finding adventures that do have a spin on them from the original, seeing how they did it and say, hey, you know, that sounds like something that would be fun for me to do. You know, I am somewhat, interested in doing the Secret of the Sinister Salt Marsh.
Ah, yeah.
Just because it's a sea adventure, it's right there. You know, it's got some, you know. And again, you know, every time I see that, when I first saw it, I said, "Is this a D&D adventure or is it Call of Cthulhu?" You know, because it had all the hallmarks of both. And you know, and these days I'd be like, "Why not both?" So that's what I would do. The only thing else that I have done that really was so completely lifted from another source was there was a book called Inferno, okay, that was written by Jerry Purnell, and it has a sequel to it, which is about a science fiction writer who wakes up in hell because, you know, he deserved it. And so
as most writers do,
and he goes on a journey much like, you know, another famous person go all the way to the center of hell and, you know, runs into you know, all these people along the way and all these situations. And so I basically, in my D&D campaign, I said, okay, fine. You know, one of the characters died. He was a priest of Asmodeus. So, of course, he's in hell. So I sent them to hell to try to get him out. So they had to basically go all the way to hell, find the devil, you know, come up with make him a deal of some kind to allow him to come back. you know, or something. Just get him to release his soul so they could resurrect him, because he wouldn't come back. And I used all the different set pieces that was in Inferno as far as it was for their adventures. So I was taking a literature and turning it into D&D encounters. So they had like the planes where, you know, droplets of fire were falling out of the sky constantly and burning you. So everyone was always running around and smacking themselves and trying to put themselves out. But they would regenerate because they were in hell, and you can't die in hell. So they were always coming, getting better. And then there was this one place that was a lake of boiling water, and there was all these people that were stuck in it. They tried to get out. The devils that were on the banks would stab them and push them back in. So there was a whole bunch of them, and some of them, the people, the nastier of the bunch of the people in hell, basically took the people who'd just been stabbed, grabbed them, tied them up, and basically threw them together into a pile high enough for them to be outside the water, and they stood on top of the water, trying to keep other people from pulling them down and taking their place, getting out of the water.
Ah.
Meanwhile, the people that were in the water were just, you know, constantly drowning, constantly boiling their flesh, you know, but of course never dying, because you can't die, because, you know, it's the afterlife. So anyways, that was so I had a lot of fun doing that, trying to get these people finally to the center, giving them quests built upon these set pieces and getting them there. So that was I did that, but like I said, it's most of the time when I think about, you know, new adventures, it's I start thinking about, like I say, these Goodman games, these old D&D type adventures, because with very little change, all you do is change the dungeon dressing, and it's you know, it's people dealing with aliens, it's people dealing with you know, cryptids, it's people dealing with a D&D adventure that was designed for another system, and you just translate to the current one. So that's how I do it. I keep, you know, every once in a while someone will say, hey, yeah, remember this adventure? That was so cool. And I'll be like, yeah, yeah. And then I'll think about taking it and putting it in. So, you know, look over your old notes. Look over your old, get into that supply of old modules that almost every GM and player has, you know, and let's say, you know, and ask yourself, you know, would this be fun to run for my players? Or if you're a player, hey, why don't I give the GM a break and me run this, you know, in whatever game that you're playing in, you know, and that way you get experience being a GM using something that you really love. And you'll bring the awesome. And if you do nothing else, take something that you thought was awesome out of it, and put it into your current. Just lift it entirely and put it into your current thing. You know, why can't they find one of those magical pools in whatever your adventure is doing? I mean, for heaven's sakes, you play any of the Tomb Raider. I mean, I thought originally Tomb Raider was going to be more like Indiana Jones, and so I saw all the mythology that was.
Yeah.
There. You know, and so, yeah, and, you know, of course, she's fighting skeletons and things like that all the time. So, yeah, do that, you know, you know, if it's a science fiction game, you know, well, you know, they're basically reanimated by nanites, you know, that the nanites that basically plate themselves around somebody's skeleton and give them motive, and now they're getting up and they're attacking you because they're nanites.
Oh no, I've done the retooling of fantasy world, and I've done it for Star Trek. I'm going to be doing it here for this Macross game. Oh no,
yeah.
Between nanites and genetic engineering and a little bit of psionics, you could do fantasy stuff. Oh, that Pegasus, yeah, it's a horse with wings. It's a minor telekinetic gift, the psychological crutches that it has to flap the wings to fly. But,
right.
And I did find out about Judges Guild, by the way. They returned in 99, redid some stuff. In 2002, the aforementioned Necromancer Games, who, again, City of Brass did, They did stuff, revised editions. 2006, licensed The Winterlands, a high fantasy setting to James Mishler's Adventure Games Publishing, and did they did the Castle and Crusades rules. And then also, Judges Guild licensed Goodman Games and Eostros Games to publish revised editions of two or three ones. They were released in 07. The son of the creator, Bob Bledsaw, inherited the company, and he redid stuff. And then in 2014, Judges Guild came back with Goodman Games to release deluxe hardback editions of the original JG products, including accompanying pages from their house organ, the Judges Guild Journal. So yeah, Judges Guild did make several returns throughout, well, 25 years from 15 years from 99 to 2014. They brought back their stuff repeatedly for D20 and other systems. So yeah, they're still sort of around. But it's been now about 10 years since they've done anything. So, yeah, JG stuff you can look up and find at, like, probably, well, I don't know, they may be at DriveThruRPG, probably at NobleKnight.com, which is Knight with a K, so NobleKnight.com. They sell a lot of used gaming and stuff, so.
Right. So, you know, as we close up this session, I think I'd list... one person's idea of the top 10 favorite published adventures. Number 10 is the Great Modron March from Planescape.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. One is called, second, number 9 is One Shots, Unknown Armies. Number 8, the Great Pendragon Campaign from Pendragon, which is Greg Stadfer's masterpiece. So if you wanted something that really did the Arthurian stuff, you know, that would be it. And then, of course, number 7, Horror on the Orient Express, Call of Cthulhu, which is the one I'm interested in. Then we have City of Lies from The Legend of the Five Rings.
Okay.
It says it's not much of a campaign. It's a detailed city mini sandbox where every resident is on the verge of backstabbing everybody else for their individual reasons. Nothing else. That's a whole bunch of interesting NPCs. Tribe 8 Adventure Cycle, which is 9 volumes. It's, okay, it's The Wings of the Valkyrie Champions. It's a time travel adventure.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Let's see here. 3, Beyond the Mountains of Madness, Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And then 2, The Enemy Within, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay.
Okay.
Again, it's an epic campaign that defined the Warhammer Fantasy world, where it starts with a bunch of lowly peasants finding about a conspiracy, and then revealing the larger stage of the Warhammer world and the eternal conflict between civilization and chaos manifest. And finally, the number 1, The Mass of Narlatep, Call of Cthulhu. And this is basically a world traveling adventure, fighting a global network of cultists. So that's one person's list. So as you can see, there's this person apparently really likes Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Okay. And some other ones are from somebody else is The Evil Eye, which is a second edition Ravenloft adventure. And then there's The Frozen Reaches, which is for Rogue Trader. This seems to be all... Oh, Satellite Down, first edition Twilight 2000. Bad Blood for Through the Breach. Central Valley Gate from Torg, which is something we don't hear hardly anything about.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah. Operation Hard Sell, also Torg. And again, Relics of Power Trilogy, the Destiny Map, the Probability Chalice, and the Forever City, which is also Torg. So this person really liked Torg.
Yeah.
And if you really want to go back to the really ancient stuff, we got Murder on Arcturus Station, Classic Traveler.
Okay.
Return to the Tomb of Horrors. I personally ran Tomb of Horrors and hated it. Because it was just a meat grinder, and the players lied to me constantly, saying, "No, really, we could do this. No, you really can't come out of the Sphere of Annihilation. You know, it just takes a wish."
Wow.
Stuff, yeah. So there's everything. Mutants and Masterminds. Isle of Dread, I have used as an adventure.
Just oh, my God.
Just because it has dinosaurs on it.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, of course, the queen, you know, the D1 through 3, the Queen of the Spiders. Of course, everyone has their list. There's lots and lots of them out there. Again, I don't know how much they cost because D&D products and a lot of these published modules are just going, unless you can get it as a reprint, are going for enormously high prices. So you're best luck on that. And, you know, if worse comes to worse, okay, you can ask one of your players or another player, what's your favorite adventure that you have them give it to you, and then you use it and retool it and yep. See if they can recognize it after you get done with it. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening to us. And we hope that this has helped you maybe bring some make some callbacks and maybe better utilize some of the stuff you already have, you know, without you having to go out and actually buy a lot of new stuff. Adventures that really have a meaning for you, a warm place in your heart, or possibly a terrible place in your heart that you want to redeem. But, you know, things that will basically push you in a direction that if you were to make up the adventure just, you know, now, it would be totally different. So do those callbacks even to yourself, because the adventure you end up is going to be your own in any way, in any event. Because, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're looking for ways to bring the awesome to your table. And that means that you're already, you know, ready to do things that are not just the common everyday, follow the rules, check off the boxes. So this is one way of doing that. And so we hope you'll do that and tell us about your successes and failures, just like we just did. And we will have more for you next week. But you have to wait until then. This is Bruce Sheffer saying there are a million, million worlds out there, so go explore them.
And this is Trav. There's a reason why it's called gaming. It's for having fun.
Gaming on the Frontier podcast is wholly owned by its hosts. It is released under the Creative Commons 3.0 license. No commercial reproduction and any use of any element of the podcast must be attributed to the Gaming on the Frontier podcast.
Hi, this is Trav from the Travcast. Listen to me Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on listen.dementiaradio.org/8027.